what might be the possible legal defense for Nicholas Cruz, the shooter that is responsible for those 17 deaths in Florida. On the KSRO live line with us is CNN analyst Paul Callen. Good morning, Paul. Thanks for being here.
Oh, nice to be with you, Pat.
I have to note that you were also a New York City homicide prosecutor and a criminal defense attorney, and so you walked both the sides of that street.
Yes, I have walked on both sides.
And there is, I mean, it seems like the overall, well, there's not a conclusion now, but what is being presented about Nicholas Cruz is his very difficult childhood. Is it an insanity defense that they're going for?
I think they are going for an insanity defense because, frankly, that's the only defense that they would have in this case. I mean, obviously, proving that he committed these horrible murders is a very easy thing.
Yeah, not difficult.
It's not a question of proving his guilt there. You know, under Florida law, to prove insanity, you have to show that the defendant had a disease or defect of some kind that caused him not to understand the consequences of his act, i.e. that pointing a gun at somebody would kill somebody, or that it was wrong to kill somebody. And I don't think that's going to fly with him because, remember, there are lots of posts by him on social media where he was talking about becoming a professional
shooter. Yeah, it seemed pretty clear-cut, yeah.
He planned, obviously, by going out and buying his AR-15 and by getting additional clips of ammunition. He planned very carefully how he did the assault. Remember, he set the fire alarm off so all the kids would run out in the hallway and be easy targets. So it's crystal clear that even though he may suffer from depression or some kind of mental defect, he understood exactly what he was doing, and he understood exactly the consequences of what he was doing. So I think he loses an insanity defense.
And so if that's true, Paul, then we go to the sentencing phase. And if he, you know, he's pled guilty or he's confessed already anyway. But then we keep hearing story after story after story about his difficult childhood and about, in fact, how many, you know, red flags have been raised over the course of his young life. And so are we only talking about, you know, the difference in sentencing and what that might be?
Well, I think, Pat, the thing we're looking at now is the issue of the death penalty, because the prosecutor under Florida's one of those states that still has a death penalty in place.
Yeah.
And this certainly looks like the kind of case that you would ask for the death penalty.
It certainly does.
So defense attorneys will be looking to show what they call mitigating circumstances, and there'll be a heavy focus on his difficult upbringing. He recently had lost his mother. There's no father in the picture, and he's suffering from, you know, depression from what I've read in the newspapers. All of those will be presented to the jury as mitigating factors to cause the jury to possibly give him life without parole as opposed to the death penalty. And that's what this case is really going to be about, that fight, if the prosecutor seeks the death penalty, which I think he will. I think he really has to. But, you know, and how a jury will decide the death penalty, listen, you never know. If they look at him and say, he's got a mental illness issue, he's, you know, his parents weren't
there.
There's
nobody
for
to stand up for him.
Circumstances.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they'll cut him a break and let him go for a life sentence. But, you know, I wouldn't count on it. With 15 victims, and it's not just 15 victims, by the way, 15 deaths. People forget there are many more still in the hospital.
17, I understood it to be, 17, and many more injured, And, Paul, you're an analyst, so that means on CNN, and that means that you get to think about and speak about, you know, more than just the facts in this case. And the mental illness quotient does seem to play into it for in a big way in this case. And so it seems, I'm just wondering if, in your experience as a prosecutor, as a defense attorney, and, you know, with all the things that you can talk about being an analyst, you know, how effective will this particular thing be, not in Cruz's case necessarily, or the way this comes out, but in terms of bringing up and people paying attention to that element of a person who commits these kinds of crimes?
Well, you know, I think it's a critical factor, and the truth of the matter is that in most of these mass killings, there's always a claim, at least, of the existence of some kind of mental illness.
Sure.
I mean, you have to think who could do this unless they were mentally ill in some way. But, you know, the law has never recognized mental illness as a defense unless it's so severe that it really incapacitates your ability to know the difference between right and wrong, because, frankly, most criminals have some kind of low-level mental illness going on.
Yeah, because, again, you'd kind of have to.
Are.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have to. So it's really very difficult to prevail with the insanity defense. And, you know, I think you raise a larger question, though, that I think is the most interesting question that comes out of this. You know, there's a lot of criticism of the FBI because they were placed on notice that this kid was posting bizarre messages that were indicating a desire to shoot or at school. And, I mean, there were lots of red flags, as you said a few moments ago. But the larger question is, you know, what does the FBI do in that kind of situation? They come out, say they interview him. They can't make a case against him. We don't have the manpower to, you know, put an FBI agent on his house and follow him around.
Yeah, apparently not.
In the event that he's going to, commit an act like this. So it's a very, very difficult situation for law enforcement, even when there's a red flag on somebody, because there are a lot of people out there capable probably of this kind of crazy stuff.
And you can say the same about really any terrorism suspect.
Yes.
Or the same kind of thing. We just don't have the manpower to do it. Were you surprised, though, Paul, when Christopher Wray, the head of the FBI, comes out fairly shortly after this happened and says, oh, my gosh, we blew it?
I was
shocked that happened.
I was
happened.
Shocked as well,
yeah.
Because remember, Christopher Wray's been under such pressure in his new job working for Donald Trump,
yeah,
and all the criticism that Trump's been throwing at the FBI. So for him to throw himself under the bus so early on, you know, I thought you'd see the FBI trying to hedge and say, you know, something came our way, but it wasn't clear that, you know, he was a threat. But,
yeah, or maybe a leak. You know, a leak in the FBI, a source that says, you know, I think something was incorrectly done here, but not the head of the FBI himself coming out within a matter of hours and saying we blew it.
But, you know, PR specialists, and, you know, I know from having been involved in some high-profile cases as a prosecutor and a defense attorney, a lot of times the PR people say, you know, if you've got a client who has a major problem and it's going to be publicized, it's best to get out in front of it.
Yeah.
And I think essentially that's what the FBI decided. You know, we're going to get smashed on this thing, so let's get in front of it. Let's have the director apologize for the error. And it really has kind of passed. I mean, it was a huge story last week, but it's not in the newspaper so much.
Yeah, it's very surprising to me. And it sounds like the same people who may have advised Christopher Wray to come out ahead of that story and tell that part of the story are the same people who have been advising a lot of the men accused of sexual misconduct, et cetera, to say, hey, you know, if you can get out in front of it, you best do it and you best apologize.
Yeah. We've seen, of course, unfortunately, we've seen a lot of that in recent months. So
No question about it. So, you know, we've been talking, banding this about as everyone in the country has been since last Wednesday. And we're wondering your opinion, Paul, on whether because the voices in the discussion have changed this time around, that most of the conversation is happening amongst the students this time and the kids standing up and say, hey, we need to go to school without fear. Will that change or make a real impact in this whole issue?
That's a great question because, you know, after that Sandy Hook Elementary School tragedy in Connecticut, when nobody could imagine that we wouldn't have done some major
we all thought
to
that
solve
yep.
the gun problem with all of those little kids killed, and nothing happened, of course. But the difference here is, and I think you've got your eye on it, this is like a children's crusade that, and they're getting a lot of publicity.
Indeed.
And these kids are social media savvy, so it's really a new way to get the message out that something should be done about these guns, and particularly, you know, the AR-15 and these military-style rifles, which, to me, I don't know why anybody who is, you know, even, you know, a strong advocate of the Second Amendment and a hunter and believes strongly in the right to bear arms, why you would need a military-style weapon that's essentially designed to kill human beings.
Well,
and what it does is it draws kids toward it. It draws crazy, you know, mentally disturbed people toward that weapon.
Well, there's a lot more conversation to have about it. Unfortunately, we're out of time, Paul, but thanks so much for being here with us this morning.